Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the strawberry watermelon refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
All right, welcome. Here we go. Closing arguments just wrapped up in the Lindsey Clancy case. What happens next? What could be the possible outcomes for Lindsey Clancy? We are going to break all of that down in great detail today. We got a great panel to do exactly that. Lindsey Clancy's jury has sat through 21 days of testimony, 84 witnesses, closing arguments. They have just taken place. And now that they've ended, 12 people have to decide whether a mother who admits to killing her 3 children goes to prison or goes to a psychiatric hospital. Eric Fatt is defense attorney, former prosecutor. Joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, and masterclass extraordinaire. Can I say
nice
that
ad.
One?
Yes, you can. Yeah, we are live with our masterclass.
Okay, and link is in the description. Robin has a master class now, which is freaking amazing. Go and check that out. Okay, Eric, let's begin with this. Nobody in this case is arguing about what happened. The children are dead. Clancy admits she did it. The only question the jury has to answer now is whether she was criminally responsible when she did the act. So what does that task now actually look like inside this courtroom with these jurors, more importantly, in the jurors' deliberation room, now that the instructions have been given, and it's up to them to decipher whether or not she was there. She was mentally with it. She could tell right from wrong. Again, there's so many caveats, because every time I say one of these things, it breaks it down. Well, what does right from wrong mean in that stage? What's your best way of describing it here?
Sure. So, Tony, in these cases, during closing arguments, I'll usually give the jury some recommendations in terms of how to go about their job back in that deliberation room. So in this case, part of that job is going to be determining, has the prosecution proven beyond a reasonable doubt that she could appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct? And so essentially no new right from wrong. And also whether she could conform her actions to the law. And so you can kind of go about that in a stepwise fashion. And really the question for the jury, Tony, is whether there's a reasonable doubt as to whether she's criminally responsible. It's not, you know, did the defense prove that she is not criminally responsible? Because that's not their burden. Is there a reasonable doubt? Is there a lingering question that is significant in the juror's mind as to whether she is criminally responsible in terms of being able to know right from wrong and conform her behavior to the law? That is the overarching inquiry.
You know, given how complex this case has been, I mean, in all honesty, I've probably learned more covering this case than any case we've covered in the last 4 years with Tony, because there's so many different things we had to learn about. I mean, we're watching Reddington, who admitted, you know, outside the courtroom as well, you know, what he had to learn about postpartum psychosis, postpartum depression, women's health, the medical system. I mean, we're all covering this so closely that it's been a massive education on a lot of sides and seeing failures on others. With all this complexity and the lawyers trying to break it down to be consumable by these really heroic jurors that have to have the hardest decision now, what do you think is the hardest instruction, if you could guess, for them to follow on this? Because there's going to be many of them, or maybe there's not. Maybe it's pretty simple. I just don't know.
You know, there's a central instruction, Robin, that's given in every case of which I'm aware that's criminal. And that is that the jurors cannot let sympathy or prejudice influence their deliberations. So that's the thing. This is a heart-wrenching case. It is so evocative. That's why, in part, it's gotten so much attention. But the jurors have to, you know, do they have to turn off their hearts? It depends on how you interpret that instruction. But to try to have some sort of cold, calculated legal analysis about this case without emotions playing into it one way or the other, emotions for three dead children and emotions for a mother who was clearly suffering, those things should not enter into the deliberations. We'll see if the jury can do that.
Which is the hardest thing to do because, I mean, wrapping your head around it, I mean, you got to have a tiebreaker because each of the, both the prosecution and the defense mental health experts that came up there are basically saying all exactly the same thing. She had a very, very, very broken brain. And it's that split whether it's criminal responsibility or not. And it's a coin toss according to which psych you're talking to. And then if you're left with, well, the data is divided, what am I left with to break that tie? It's what I gut feel about it, which is an emotion. I mean, it's really tough. So when you're faced with that, Eric, how do you advise someone that has that tie internally when they don't know which way to go?
I think you say that they have to follow the law. These are the jury instructions here. We don't expect y'all to be robots, but we also don't expect y'all to have any sort of sympathy or contempt or any sort of those right. feelings. Weigh on that calculus that you have to balance for making a determination.
The lesser charge of manslaughter has been introduced here. And I listened to the jury instructions this morning, too. I've watched many jury instructions. I know you've seen them far more than I have. But, I mean, they're long. They're, you know, just lingering on and on. But then on this, you got to look at it this way. My mind's spinning by the time it's done. I can only imagine theirs is spinning by the time it's done. I kind of think I understand how they work. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to appreciating the wrongfulness of her conduct. And then you add the manslaughter in there as a possible outcome, as a lesser charge. Does that confuse the jury? It help us as the non-weighing jury, the general public jury that has their opinion on this.
Armchair jury, help
us understand for the armchair jury, Eric, what the manslaughter charge could possibly mean. What the jury would have to accept for them to render that as their verdict here versus not guilty by reason of insanity, essentially.
you know, what we're talking about just shows how difficult the juror's role can be. So look, the jury could decide on the top count of murder that, you know, we're not saying she is lacking criminal responsibility, but we don't think there was an intent to kill, or we don't think there was premeditation, or however the jury comes out on that. That doesn't mean that Lindsay Clancy's off the hook. There's this lesser included of manslaughter, where if the jury says, hey, we don't know about premeditation, we don't know that she was thinking about this for a long time and planning it, but maybe she did it, and we're not so jazzed about the lack of criminal responsibility, this lesser included charge provides the jury sort of a compromise verdict if they were to go that route, whereby they would determine that Lindsay Clancy either knowingly or with gross criminal negligence or recklessly caused the deaths of these children. There are less elements for the prosecution to prove on that. It's a lower burden in that sense. And that I think it's more likely that they would come, if they come to a guilty verdict, I think manslaughter is more likely. And then lastly, the lack of criminal responsibility piece, if the jury goes that route, that takes away all the criminal charges, whether it's murder or manslaughter. So a lot of moving parts.
You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Todd.
I want when we're talking about that, and we're talking about, you know, appreciating the wrongfulness of all this on the jury instructions. I mean, there was a lot in there, and I'm just curious to get your opinion on this. Does the language of jury instructions need to be updated to current times? Because in the same realm of having to not let sympathy or prejudice influence your decisions, there's so much language in the jury instructions that are, it's emotional. There's so much in there that is about, and I'm trying to paraphrase, I didn't write it down earlier, but when I was listening, I'm like, that's confusing to me, where it's talking about things being like horrific and disturbing. Those are emotional terms. Those aren't legal terms. So you're asking the jury to weigh things on terms that are emotional to them, but at the same point telling them that sympathy and prejudice can influence their decision. That's literally how some of the instructions kind of go. It's a really look over here, but don't consider this part, but kind of weigh some of this over here, but don't weigh it when you're considering. I mean, what the what's your thoughts?
It's sort of like, I don't know if you've seen that meme of Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny, where he's in front of a whiteboard and he has all these things connections made, and he's, you know, beside himself, bewildered about this task.
Yeah.
That's how I imagine that jury feels back in that room.
Oh,
and some of these instructions, Tony, were written decades and decades ago.
I know, it's like witch trial instructions.
Yeah, you know, verbiage has changed. Really, the common meaning of some of these terms has changed.
Yeah.
And on top of that, if you've sat through a jury instruction advisement, it can go for more than an hour with all these unfamiliar terms. How helpful is that really to the jury for them to do their job?
I'd be more confused after it than ever. I was waiting for it to be like, and if you believe, she might be operating a coven out of the back of her house. Like, where did that one? I'm obviously making that one up. I'm sorry, Robin, go ahead.
Yeah, no, all I want to do is listener brought up, and I know we keep focusing on this aspect of it, but at the same time, hands down, you know, I want to make sure we remember the victims' names, Cora, Dawson, and Kaylin, Callan, the, you know, the three lives that were lost at the hands of Lindsay, as we're trying to figure out and understand what inspired her to do it, whether it's criminal responsibility or not. And now going back to that, what I'm still curious about this manslaughter possibility, What do you think inspired the judge to do that, to add that in there? Because I've never, again, you've seen many more than I, obviously, but I haven't seen any of the cases we covered where the judge added his own charge. And how common or unusual is that? And that charge, do you think it helped the prosecution, helped the defense, or was he purely putting it in there for the jury's benefit?
In Colorado, where I practice, one side or the other has to request those lessers. Usually, it's the prosecution who asks the judge, hey, we need to add this charge as what's called a lesser included, or defense will say lesser non-included. But at any rate, that, I think, helps the prosecution, because this is such an emotionally charged case. These jurors, the burden that they have, the weight that they must be feeling in terms of the decision they got to make must be immense. And so there are some folks who might in that jury room say, hey, there are three dead kids here. We got got to do something about this. Maybe it's not first degree murder, but gosh, shouldn't she have some legal responsibility for this if that's the route they go? And if so, these lesser included like manslaughter provide that potential compromise verdict. And so I think it gives the jury another option between, you know, was this the worst crime we can that's on the books, or is she not responsible at all? Maybe there's some middle ground the jury comes to, and maybe that's manslaughter.
Yeah, it's like a relief valve from all the pressure of the one, because you can't. Yeah. Do you think, I'm guessing the attempt was to also lessen the probability of a hung jury?
Yes, I think that you're absolutely right, Robin, that it's going to be difficult for these jurors back there. And if they're like, hey, we can't all agree on the top charge, but maybe we all can live with this other charge, that wouldn't be uncommon.
And one more follow-up. Why wouldn't have the prosecution gone with this charge to begin with?
Sometimes you don't want to convey to the jury that you're not confident in your case. And when you add if the prosecution were to add a lesser included like manslaughter, that might tell the jury, hey, we really believe that it's first degree murder, but we don't totally believe that because this other charge might be applicable too. Sometimes they go for broke with the top charge and don't want any lessers.
Thanks, it's the defense who actually added it in, who asked the judge. Reddington's the one who wanted that added in there. Yeah.
Even though we think it might benefit the prosecution. I'm sorry, Tony.
Look, it benefit Lindsay too. It puts a middle ground there to get to a conclusion. Grant, I mean, Eric, let me ask you this. When it comes, if she were to be found guilty and it's a manslaughter charge, obviously it is a lesser penalty. But what does that look like for her in terms of, is it an automatic ticket to prison? Does it help her get into a mental health facility rather than a prison? Is that sort of consideration taken into account here? What does it mean other than just, it's likely a lesser sentence of time.
That's really the primary function, is that it limits the potential exposure in terms of incarceration for Lindsay Clancy, and it limits it substantially. You know, we're talking first degree murder is up into life without the possibility of parole. Manslaughter in most jurisdictions is something substantially lower, depends on the jurisdiction, but could be like 5 to 15 years, something like that. And with good time, earned time, and other considerations, it could result in a person convicted of that being out, in a relatively manageable number of years, at least considering what she's facing.
What sort of control does the judge have over where Lindsay ends up going at the end of the day? Like, if she is found guilty here, let's say it's not even manslaughter, let's say it is manslaughter, or it's the above charge, the murder one. Does the judge, is she automatically going to a prison, or does the judge have any sort of say of saying, yes, you're going away forever, but it's not to an actual prison, it's going to be back to Tewksbury or the state hospital or something of that nature? Is there any direction there, or is that Bureau of Prisons, or is there really nobody that has a choice? You're found guilty, you're going to prison. And there's no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Judges really try to stay out of incarceration placement post-conviction, in part because they don't have jurisdiction over these different facilities. They have jurisdiction over the parties. They can say, hey, defendant, I can make you do something. But they can't make some white-collar prison take her if the prison doesn't want to. That's really a determination between in a state court case, it would be the equivalent of the Bureau of Prisons for the state of Massachusetts. They would decide, but it's not going to be some kind of mental health facility. It's going to be a prison. Okay. If there is such a conviction, there's no discretion to say, hey, instead of a real prison, we're going to put you in a doctor's office or something.
Yeah, I looked that up a couple of weeks ago at the onset of this, you know, possible sentencing if she was found guilty. And then Siobhan covered a little bit too about the process. As I understand it, if she's convicted, she goes to the state prison. She's put in a holding cell, like we saw with Koberger, to be evaluated. And based on that evaluation, a placement inside the prison itself will happen. If she's evaluated to have mental health issues, which she does, she can be placed in a separate mental health unit, but not with nearly the same care. And this is what Siobhan was talking about the other day, but not nearly the same care as she would be if she's staying where she's currently at. As well as the added challenge of this is because she's still on S watch 24/7, that's going to be the immediate thing that they're going to have to accommodate as well. Plus being paralyzed from the waist down. So I was researching like how they accommodate that. That's going to be most likely in many cases, not all, but from what I read, another prisoner that takes care of that aspect of her, which makes her vulnerable. I mean, just it's so complicated. It's unbelievable.
I want to ask you about the S watch, Eric, because obviously they've needed to keep her alive to get her to trial. I'm curious on the logistics of how that actually functions beyond just we're going to keep her alive because we really want to get her to trial, but we're going to keep her alive because that's like the morally right thing to do because we're not fucking monsters. When this extra weight of, well, there's a trial coming up, let's keep her alive, is gone because the trial is done. Is there the same weight that is put on the S watch? How much influence does an attorney, do you as an attorney have over S watch on a client that you're very concerned that may end it because they got nothing to live for, this sort of a case, but we need to keep them alive for trial versus trial's done. There's advocating, but does it change the equation a bit behind bars or in a mental health facility in terms of how well that watch is being done, I guess.
Yeah, you know, in my opinion, the S watch in most facilities is, like you said, the objective is to keep them alive. It's not to make them not want to engage in that type of behavior. And so to keep them alive for trial, that's one thing. But after the trial is done, certainly there's an objective to keep them alive. But what care is really being given to sort of reform their mental processes, if possible, and get them better? That's not the objective. It's even less of an objective after trial. And the attorney, the most they can do is make threats. They could if they think that there might be inhumane conditions, they could contact the jail and say, "Hey, if you don't fix this, we're going to sue you for cruel and unusual punishment civilly." And sometimes the jail will make changes. Oftentimes, they'll simply ignore that. And so, not a ton of power for the attorney on that either.
And think about this too, because if she's on S watch in a Gen Pop prison, most times that says you're going to be in isolation, which is then throwing kerosene back on the fire, which causes the mental health issues, which is going to make her decline again even more for a higher risk of S. I mean, it's like a never ending cyclical cycle of crazy.
Now, how much, let me ask you this, Eric, how much has this been a battle of terminology and how clear do you think it is to the jurors going back about the words that have been used here? The prosecution's own rebuttal expert, Dr. Avram Mack, told this jury that Clancy was in a severe depressive episode. He wouldn't call it psychosis. Some of the other experts did. Other experts also said bipolar. But the legal standard doesn't say psychosis anywhere. Right. I mean, that's kind of been what we've been talking about here in the ether. But at the end of the day, it's not about psychosis or being in that specific state. It says mental disease or defect, which could be bipolar. Which could be the effects of bipolar, not necessarily being in the psychosis state. Does the jury even need the word psychosis to get there? Do they understand that going in? What's been your experience in that, Lane?
The jury does not need a specific diagnosis like psychosis or anything else in order to find Lindsay Clancy not criminally responsible. They could find that she was emotionally distressed. They could find that she was depressed. So long as there is some mental disease or defect, whatever term you give it, that is going to be enough. And on top of that, you know, the prosecution's been talking about postpartum depression, defense postpartum psychosis. You know, these are all kind of, I guess if I was hearing these over 20 days or something, that they might get jumbled together. And I think it's sort of is to the benefit of the defense in the sense that we all agree there was some serious mental health stuff going on. So I think that mental disease or defect piece has already been met, regardless of whether the jury accepts psychosis. Now, the other requirements, that's a different analysis.
Yeah, because it comes down to everyone agrees mental disease, mental health issues, severe. And everyone just keeps arguing criminal responsibility or not.
Well, I think there's a comment here that was just made, and I think this is like the crux of how a lot of people are. I feel like the interpretation is being messed up in people's minds, and that she take responsibility for what she did to her own babies. She has. Mm-hmm. Wait, show me where she hasn't taken
responsibility. She admitted it.
She admitted it. She's taken responsibility. She's asking to be judged by the letter of the law, not by the people with the pitchforks who are angry that are screaming about babies. This is not a woman who hasn't not taken responsibility. She's not sitting there and going, Patrick did it, like half of the people out there are. She has taken responsibility. I guess, what is that in people's minds, the idea of her taking responsibility? Do you want her to go and say, I killed them because they were evil children and I wanted to have a different life? Is that your version of responsibility? Because that's not reality. That's not what she was feeling. That's not what her track record and her history and her documented writings of what's going on in her mind show. Would that make everyone happy if she just spews out a bunch of shit like that that's not even real? Is that taking responsibility? Or is taking responsibility exactly what we've been watching in that courtroom for the last month?
Yeah, I think it's a really insightful point because you know, this isn't a person who was like, I have these mental health issues, but I didn't really do anything about them. I didn't care. They were affecting my behavior. I was starting to do weird stuff, and I wasn't even trying to manage that. And then this horrible thing happened, and too bad, and I want to move on with my life. That's not at all been the tenor of how she has handled her portion of this.
Yeah.
The responsibility thing, yeah, she said, I did it. And then what she wanted to do, now she wants to die. She's not fighting. Reddington's fighting for her, on her behalf, because she is claiming responsibility that I did this horrendous thing and I just want to die.
I don't know how anyone could take more responsibility other than the, like, kill me, which she's already pretty much said she wants to die. I mean, if you gave her the option, I think she probably would have pulled that lever.
And would now. That's why she's
would
on.
Now.
Because as they're showing, as they're demonstrating, even the prosecution psychologists are shocked at how long she's been on S-Watch. 3 years, one-on-one, because it's that severe. And so you have people like Reddington coming in that are true believers in her and the mental health crisis that's going on in Massachusetts, if not all over the place. And you have them champion on her behalf because she has claimed responsibility, as according to all the testimony she fought. And everyone agrees, this isn't Robin's conjecture, in the testimony, she fought hard for help. She didn't get the help she needed. She kept shopping around for more help because it wasn't working. I mean, all these things that we saw throughout this testimony, that is responsibility. And the ultimate responsibility, she doesn't want to live because of it. And so what's going on is others are battling on her behalf for not just her, but the system that needs to be fixed, I think.
I don't know. It's kind of amazing what people will conjure up or the ways things will be twisted. And I don't think it's intentional. I just think it's right. Like we think about these things on certain paths, and this is so far off the norm that it is. We got to kind of like take our shift and go, okay, this is not common. This is not normal. We have to look at it over here with a bit of a different set of rules or a different magnifying glass, because this is not a common situation for many people. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's talk about not guilty. What could possibly happen there if this jury finds Lindsay Clancy not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility? She doesn't walk out of the courtroom. She goes somewhere else. And the question everybody in the audience is asking is what somewhere else actually means for the woman who's already paralyzed, already in a hospital, and already on 24-hour S-Watch. Under Massachusetts law, not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect verdict does not mean release. The court can order the defendant hospitalized for up to 40 days of observation. After that, the DA or hospital superintendent can petition for involuntary commitment. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, is here with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. So what happens in the courtroom, Eric, the moment the verdict is read, if it is not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, what happens to Lindsay at that moment?
Yeah, you know, Lindsay's not going home. He's not going home anytime soon. That's for darn sure. Either way, regardless of what the jury comes out with. So, you know, her supporters who might be outside the courthouse, they're not going to see her. It's not going to be something like that. Instead, she's going to go through that 40-day commitment at a psychiatric facility. They're going to assess whether – they're going to assess her dangerousness. And then after that, the DA can petition to continue the involuntary commitment. And that petition can be reevaluated every year. But it's also kind of an indefinite sentence into the psychiatric facility. So it could be forever. It could be a year and a half. There's such a wide range in terms of what this might look like in the coming years for Lindsey Clancy.
How much does this vary from state to state in as far as how they hold someone? Because just from experience and seeing other cases and just life, you know, psychiatric facilities, unless they're getting paid and your insurance is covering it, they don't necessarily want to keep you there unless they have no choice but to keep you there by law. How much or how willing, I guess, are facilities, and I guess it varies by facility, but state law too, to keep the person there? How often do you see folks, I mean, it's rare that anyone wins a defense of this sort of argument, but the ones that do, how often do they stay incarcerated or in a mental health facility indefinitely? I know Andrea Yates is still there because she wants to be. Different state, though. Different set of laws. Is that the same sort of thing everywhere, where if Lindsey Clancy is to say, keep me locked up here, I don't want to be out, that they would honor that? Or is it at some point, we think you're good enough to go? Because they do that all the time with 72-hour holds and things of that nature, where people are not good to go, but guess what? Insurance ain't covering the bill anymore, so enjoy the paper bag and the bridge down by the river. What are your thoughts?
Right. You know, we like to think that these determinations in terms of whether to let somebody out from a psychiatric facility after being found not guilty by reason of insanity are by the letter of the law. They're by the book. And hey, if you know, we look at these three things, and if they're met, we let them out. If they're not, we don't. The reality is much more complicated. There are other interests involved. There are funding interests. You know, to house a human being inside of a facility and make sure they're fed and, you know, don't die and things like that. So just like a normal prison, that costs tens of thousands per year per person. And they have thousands of, or not, if not more, people in these facilities. So when we add into that the level of care that might be required for somebody in Lindsey Clancy's situation, you better believe that facility might be looking at their books and they're like, gosh, we've got a funding issue. We've got monetary considerations here. Those things can creep into these determinations, whether it's talked about publicly or expressly or not.
So here are the numbers for Massachusetts, since I love looking at our numbers.
Yes.
on in between. So this is for all individuals, not just filicide in cases like this for paternal, I mean, you know what I mean, for women that were convicted and not
yes,
you know. So this is it. So this is for everyone, including males that were convicted. The shortest ever was for an older male for not criminally being responsible. The shortest ever was 3.5 years because he's older and had other issues going on. The average is about 16 years, and this is all people, not just women committed because of filicide. The shortest, I mean, I told you shortest, and the longest was about 40. So she's looking, based on this average in Massachusetts, at least about 15 years, 16 years, if she even wants to get at that point. So for those that say she's just going to walk free and go and have more babies. Now, we covered this yesterday as well. Remember, if you're looking at law of average, because some people are saying, well, she'll just get out, have more babies and do it again. No, because if we're looking at the average of 16 years, she'll be in the middle of, again,
she'll
pure speculation.
That,
past that point where she can have babies.
Yeah.
And so that won't be a concern. For those that were most concerned about her having babies and doing that again, no, it ain't going to happen.
Is there ever... is there ever conditions on releases on things like this? If she is to again, we're just trying to play out all the possibilities here because everybody's thinking of them. Not guilty, goes to a facility. Are there conditions ever of, okay, well, you don't need to live in the facility anymore, but you can't have any more babies? And short of you know, making that medically impossible. Are there ever conditions of like, well, if you get pregnant, you're coming right back here, and then the baby's going to go to, you know, foster care or something? I mean, are things like that, do those sort of, do things like that exist, Eric?
Well, they do exist in some contexts. For example, if there was someone who was convicted of a gang shooting and they went to prison, then they're on parole. You have conditions of parole. You get to be out in the community, but there are things you can't do. For example, you can't associate with known gang members. You can't be their friend. You can't go to the movies with them. So those conditions have been determined lawful, whereas courts have determined other, sometimes more exotic and uncommon conditions, unlawful. And I would venture to say that I don't think the government could prevent a person from trying to have a child if they were going to release her. I don't think they could say, hey, we'll let you out, but you cannot engage in this fundamental constitutional right of trying to procreate because we're worried something bad's going to happen. I think a judge would determine that might be cruel and unusual punishment. There might be a due process issue. I just would be very skeptical about such a condition and the lawfulness of it.
And actually, here's another practical aspect that I was just looking up. I asked the question, can she actually physically still have babies with being paralyzed from the waist down?
Sure.
Yes, possible, but it's a high-risk pregnancy. So she's got a higher risk of infections, blood clots, preterm labor, harder labor management. So she needs actually a specialized team of spinal care teams and obstetrics to actually manage that as well. So it's not impossible, but more improbable, as well as when you throw the legal issues on top of that, restrictions, the fact that the likelihood of her getting out, and then this is if she's not guilty by reason of sanity, likelihood of at least 16 years, if not longer, if by either her choice or the state's choice, I think it's really kind of a moot point.
Yeah. I mean, as far as advocacy goes for her, depending on where she ends up, obviously she has family. They've been standing behind her in court, so I would assume that they're still going to be there to an extent after, no matter where she goes. But is that, how key is that to any sort of, I don't know if treatment is the right word, or care, maybe more of the operative word. The care that she's going to get, how important is that she has people advocating for her care and her well-being versus just everyone abandoning her and saying, good luck with the system?
It is a critical piece to whether she would be released later if she is committed to a psychiatric facility, because she can petition every year in Massachusetts to try to get out. And when she does, what the court, what initially mental health folks will determine, and then perhaps a court might ultimately decide, is whether the level of dangerousness that she might have if she is let out. And it's just common sense that if a person has a pro-social support system, has people looking out for them, has a place to go, has a place to live, people who might feed her, people who might care for her, considering her physical disabilities and her mental health issues as well, that would make the fact finder much more inclined to say, hey, this person is less likely to be dangerous than someone who, if we let them out, you know, they're going under a bridge somewhere and God knows what happens after that.
Yeah. I mean, someone like her, there's high probability of abuse behind bars. There's high probability of abuse in a mental institution as well. It happens, unfortunately. So that's another thing that she's going to have to contend with. There's not, none of this is a great path for Lindsay Clancy. I mean, it's very much all, it's restrictive as it needs to be, based on what the jury is going to decide. What happens though if she is found guilty? What kind of appeals are available to her, and can she survive them? Quite literally, that's what we're about to get into as we continue our conversation here. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, and Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor. If this jury finds Lindsay Clancy guilty of first degree murder, the sentence is automatic, life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge reads it, it's done. But the case doesn't end when the sentence is read. In Massachusetts, a first degree murder conviction triggers an automatic appeal to the Supreme Judicial Court. Reddington doesn't have to really do much. The case goes up on its own. Eric, that's a good legal question. What does that automatic review actually look for? And I guess how often does anything get changed on automatic review? Or does it take a lot of advocacy from attorneys to get the Supreme Court to go, wait a second, we don't think that this is how it should have ended?
You know, automatic reviews can, unfortunately, just be folks going through the motions.
Yeah.
They've got to do this review, but we know what happened at trial, and they are probably not going to disturb what is the standard consequence for someone who's convicted of first-degree murder. So, and on top of that, gosh, you think about the conditions for a person like Lindsey Clancy inside of there. It's not that I like feel terribly bad for her. This is just a horrible situation all around. But we don't want a person unduly suffering in there. And a person who's dealing with paralysis, that's hard enough in normal everyday life outside of the prison. Think about how tough it'd be in a prison.
Yeah. And what do you think is going to be – I mean, Reddington objected many times, which gave him the jump board for an appeal in those areas. Out of all the areas he objected in, what do you think is going to be the first one he's going to use on the attack for an appeal process? Do you think has the biggest teeth? And is that what you do? Do you take the biggest one first and go with that?
Well, you've got to bring every possible potential outcome of being able to prevail on an appeal. But one thing, Robin and Tony, that we talked about last week and that really struck me as improper was the prosecution's question that to a Lindsey Clancy family member, you know, is killing your kid a mortal sin under, you know, Christian doctrine? I can't think of a more improper question that injects ideas of moral judgment, religious judgment, and how that could affect a jury. That is my first argument I'm making on appeal, is that that was wholly improper. It tainted how the jury is going to see this in such an egregious fashion that we've got to do this all over now. I think the prosecution totally screwed up on that.
And what the craziest set of circumstances, the prosecution asked the question, then the later witness said it himself, which was double down dumb. I mean, it just they've really hurt themselves on that one. So what do you think the probability of that being a success? I mean, I'm not saying 100% or anything like that. I mean, is that weighted? Do you think that's going to go well for the defense on that one, or prosecution's going to win it?
I really think they have some significant traction on that potential appeal if there is a conviction. You can't get into these jurors' minds like, oh, if you don't convict this person, God's going to be mad at you. I can't think of a more improper admission in a trial.
But, I mean, they didn't go to the jury and say, if you convict her, she's – I mean, it was directed to the witness by the attorney. There was that one, which I completely agree with everything you just said, Eric. But then later on, and I failed off the top of my head to remember exactly which doctor it was that was testifying. Maybe someone can tell me, who also brought up mortal sin. That was in a different context. And I'm curious to get your take on that, because when it was brought up a second time, number one, it told me, oh, that's where they got the word mortal sin from. They took it from the testimony they knew that was going to come up from their witness shortly down the line, and let me grab that and insert it over here because it's somehow going to support this. I think it was a horrible call, but I think that's probably where the word came from. Then you get to the doctor who was talking to her about her, trying to understand where she was coming from, and asked about her faith, asked about, you know, trying to get a full psychological picture of how this woman functions. And in that context, that doctor did ask her, essentially, you know, do you understand that murder is a mortal sin? Now, in that context, when you're trying to understand someone psychologically, their belief systems, what's going to inspire them this way and that, I think it's a fair question to ask, not because you're preaching to them or telling them that you realize this is a mortal sin and you're going to go to hell for it, but more so, is that the bearings that you were putting on the weight of your actions while you were taking, or while you were executing them, basically.
And that was Dr. Kirk Heilbrun.
Yeah. So was that a different context? Because, I mean, the judge shut that one down, too. But to me, as a layperson, it read a little different than the way the first time it was brought out by the attorney. Eric?
You know, I think it's a critical nuance, because whether Lindsey Clancy's family member thinks this alleged act was a mortal sin is not relevant at all. The jury in determining whether Lindsey Clancy is guilty shouldn't give a shit whether a family member thinks it's a mortal sin. On the other hand, whether Lindsey Clancy thinks it's a mortal sin, that is relevant. And it goes to her ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct. Gosh, if she was a devout Christian and she's talking to this doctor and her response is, yes, I think it was a mortal sin. And I thought that at the time, and that went through my head, God, what's God going to think about this? That is much more relevant to the jury deciding whether she can appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct than some family member's opinion as to whether something's a mortal sin. So, yeah, there's a big difference there.
Yeah,
I mean, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering how much, you know, should that have been shut down? Should that not have been allowed to be discussed in court the way that it was? Because again, I almost felt, look, I'm not on the side here of, you know, lock her up forever. I think she needs mental health help. But I just felt like, yeah, I mean, I think I understood where that doctor was going. Should that have been shut down, or was that improperly, you know, was that a little quick to slam on the brakes because the word had been brought up again and it had just been brought out the day before, or a couple days before?
You know, in a trial where there is not an allegation of lack of criminal responsibility, in any other trial, it would be wholly improper if a detective was asking a murder suspect, hey, don't you think it's a mortal sin because you shot this gang member? Completely improper. In this case, though, what is central to the jury's consideration is her whether she can appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct. Does that necessarily implicate these larger moral codes such as spirituality, such as Christianity? And thus, does that make that kind of fair game to talk about if you're trying to get at, how do we determine if she appreciates the wrongfulness of her conduct? Well, perhaps it is through this lens of religious doctrine. And so I think that is more so fair game than any other such reference.
Yeah, because the mortal sin was not brought up as a context for overall humanity. It was brought up in the context of a specific religion, Catholicism. And I think that's what actually, when it zeroed in on the specificity of that religion, I think that's what might have been the trigger. And then actually, when the mortal sin was brought up again, is able to be referenced. And so that's why I think Reddington's going to object to anything, obviously close to that for his own benefit and the benefit of defense.
Sure,
but
sure.
I think it was because the original religious connotation with it, not just as the overall arching.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, you can, I mean, can the jury look at this and go, okay, she understood that morally and ethically and by law, it's wrong to murder somebody in that moment. But because of the way her brain was working, whether it's psychosis or bipolar, whatever it is that is not letting her operate on full cylinder, and she was operating more so on, you know, for lack of a better term, some sort of a fucked up, you know, demented spiritual level of go to God and I'm going to leave this earth too, and then my babies are going to be coming with me. I mean, that to a lot of people, the spiritual world, God, you know, will his rules override the rules of the land, if you will. So you could, I mean, depending how you're looking at it, look at this and appreciate the wrongfulness of your actions, but fully believe that what you're doing, those actions, you know, these rules on the land don't matter because I'm operating on this higher level right now, which she did appear to think she was doing.
All right. It's complicated. So if if the jury concludes that she, like, let's just say hypothetically that they thought that she believed this was a mortal sin at the time, that this is bad, you can't do this, this is morally wrong at the time, that's a problem for the defense. However, if they then take it a step further and say, you know, she thought God was essentially directing her to do this, thereby giving her some kind of pass, some kind of way to sidestep this moral culpability that is the general rule, because if God's directly speaking to you saying, hey, no, that actually is okay, then she's not really appreciating the wrongfulness of her conduct. She doesn't think it's wrong. She thinks it's being directed by her, you know, supreme spiritual being. So it gets pretty complicated.
It does. I mean, it's not as simple as I recognize the law is wrong, because you can recognize the law is wrong, or what you're doing is wrong. But if you feel that the spirituality is overriding that, then that's what you're going to go by in some cases.
You know, it's an interesting observation I hadn't referenced in the show since we've been covering this case. It's what her appearance has been throughout this. But since we're talking about the mortal sin aspect and the Catholicism and the impact of that on the jury, I thought I'd mention it. So I noted, but no one's mentioned online that I could find, you know, this is typically what she looked like during jury, and that is, that's a cross she's wearing. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty prominent throughout. And it looks to be, you know, like an Irish Collada type cross. I always get my names messed up, but, you know, which is a Catholic looking symbolism, you know, and the mother-in-law. So I was very curious in my mind once we were having this conversation about this, whether the prosecution, again, intentionally brought that up to illustrate to the jury, without having to say it to the jury, the dichotomy sitting before them of Christian faith and killed her babies, you know, and so should burn in hell, you know. So without even having to say those things, because of how she presents and just bringing up that topic, it plants that seed. Because again, I picked up on what she was wearing as that from the very beginning, because to me, any kind of wobble of anyone strikes and that, it struck me. But no one's even covered it, so I was just kind of curious whether that was like that one of those subliminal things that was just planted as every little nugget they try to do. Anyway,
you know, on that very briefly, one possible theory from the prosecution is that they knew that this doctor was going to talk about with Lindsay Clancy whether this was a mortal sin. And then if they got it from somebody who is not experiencing any mental health issues, like the family member, and the family member would have said, yeah, that is a mortal sin. And then they would have compared that, if Lindsay Clancy would have affirmatively said to her medical providers, yes, I do think it was a mortal sin, the prosecution could say, hey, this same person is looking at this the same way the defendant is looking at this, because they are both legally sane on this issue. That might have been an approach.
Yeah. You know, in other words, planting a seed to build from.
I'm curious about that exact topic, Eric, because let's just take a step back out of the trial here for a second. There's a lot of businesses out there, especially in the South, where they will use a cross within their marketing of like their logo, whatever. It's like, you know, Tufts Plumbing, and they're like the T is a crucifix. I find it to be a little shitty. I think it's like I don't know that I necessarily trust somebody who's throwing that into their marketing material, and it's not an ulterior motive. But I'm sure there's some that are being, that's just they're living their life, and that's they like to put it into everything. Could it also backfire? I mean, what's been your experience in a courtroom when obviously the way one dresses, the way one presents itself to a jury, that's important. But when you start to mix religiosity into it and you start wearing crosses or whatever, things that somehow signal to a jury some level of religiousness in a case that so many people are looking at and just going, this is evil. Could that backfire? Could that also, could you have jurors that are going to look at her wearing a cross going, blasphemy, look what you did to your children, and you have the audacity to wear a cross in here? I mean, I can see it playing both ways, depending on how someone is coming into it with their own preconceived notions.
Oh, I think so. And you know, an analogy might be jurors do not want to feel like they're being duped. They do not want to feel like they're being manipulated, especially in such a high stakes thing like this. So like, let's say there was a personal injury case and the trial happens 3 years after the car accident and the person is injured, but they go into the courtroom with like a neck brace on. Well, typically you wouldn't have a neck brace 3 years after such an issue. You might have a surgery, you might have something else, but and the juror might look at that and be like, hey, they're trying to sell me something. They're trying to dupe me on this. I think those same risks apply to a person going in there with a cross and saying, you know, are trying to convey perhaps that they, you know, do have some holy purity and devotion to their faith and things like that, because they're trying to engender sympathy from that jury. A jury might look at that and say, hey, you off three kids. Don't try to tell me you're some nun in here. And I'm offended by that possible suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, all those things matter. Whether, yeah, you know, what one's intent is can be misinterpreted easily by someone else. But it all matters. And so it's all a weighted, weighted exercise, if you will.
I think she brought everything. Again, my interpretation of what she wore, what she brought in there, what she had in front of her throughout this was meant for her own stability throughout this thing, for her own comfort. It wasn't meant for signaling anything. But again, regardless of that fact, it has an impact on the jury. And I'm curious what Reddington thought of it.
Eric, it's now in the hands of the jury. Next time we talk, we'll probably have a verdict, I would imagine. This may air, but there may be a verdict before we even get this out. Outside of the live, where do you think it lands?
My apprehension is, I think the most likely outcome is a hung jury. Yeah. I think that this is such a polarizing case. It has divided the world, the country, the state, everything. And you better believe those divisive influences can loom heavy back in that deliberation room. I think a hung jury is most likely. I think the second most likely outcome is that she is not criminally responsible. Third most likely is that she is guilty of manslaughter. And the least likely outcome is the prosecution's going to win on that top charge of murder.
How long do you think till we get an answer?
This is not going to be like a quick one and done thing. It's not going to be like they all go in there and, we all kind of feel the same way. Let's get this done before lunch. No chance. I think we're looking at multiple days, possibly a week. Who knows?
How long will a judge allow for deliberations? Is it up to the judge pretty much? How long could this go, do you think?
It is basically up to the judge. And I'll tell you, after too much time has gone by, both sides might be going to the judge. Hey, we got to check in with these folks. Are they going to reach a determination? Are they even close? And the judge in many states can check in with the jury and they can say, hey, guys, it's been like 2.5 days. Do you think you're getting close? Are we making progress? Are things deadlocked? Something else. And so the judge sort of has to monitor that. It cannot be indefinite. And I've seen judges say, hey, after, and they give instructions saying, hey, you guys, your job is to reach a verdict. Please go back there. Please reconsider your positions. Please do this. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't happen, the judge can call it as a mistrial at some point, or a hung jury, at some point, if there has not been a termination after a reasonable amount of time.
The judge can make the call when we're done, after a certain amount of time, and it doesn't have to be the jury saying, we can't figure it out. They can be going on for a week and a half, and if they're still not there, the judge can be like, I don't think you're going to get there, so I'm going to call it, basically.
Usually the judge would need some indication from the jury that they are gridlocked or that they are practically gridlocked.
Okay.
I don't think if they checked in with the jury a week from now and the jury's like, hey, we're moving along, we're just getting through stuff, I don't think the judge is going to call it under those
circumstances. Sure. As long as there's progress being made. Right. All right. Anything else, Robin?
No. It was, as always, Eric's got an amazing insight on all these things as we keep peppering him with all these and all these random thoughts that enter my mind as we're talking about these things. So thanks, as always, Eric.
Yeah, always a fascinating conversation, an important one today as the closing arguments come down and it goes into the hands of the jury. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. If you want to go back and listen to any of the testimony in the case, you can do so on the podcast. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and find the audio you'd like to listen to. And you can listen to that testimony start to finish, whatever you're doing, wherever you are at. So be sure to check that out. All right, we'll keep covering this. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I am Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas.
This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's, but the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're gonna need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're going to need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the Strawberry Watermelon Refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're gonna need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
In the next Rare Well Done, the Thrive team helps two people with CIDP tackle the tricky issue of friendship.
Hello.
They say the quiet part out loud.
In the event my CIDP worsens, my friends might decide it's too much.
Get nudged outside their comfort zone.
I don't know if I want to.
To forge stronger connections.
The best thing that's ever happened to me, our friendship.
To Rory.
Watch Rory and Michelle take on the friendship factor on the next episode of Rare Well Done.